Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hacks is back for season 3, and so is the official Hacks podcast. In each episode, Hacks creators Lucia Aniello, Paul W. Downs, and Jen Statsky speak with cast and crew members to unpack the Emmy-winning comedy series.
You'll hear Hannah Einbinder and Jean Smart speak to their on-screen dynamic, along with stories from the show's writer's room, on-set antics, and creating the world that Deborah and Ava inhabit. Watch Hacks, streaming exclusively on Max, and listen to the official Hacks podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
Look out! It's only films to be buried with Judgment Day.
Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried with Judgment Day. My name is Brett Goldstein. I'm a comedian, an actor, a writer, a director, a teriyaki sauce, and I love films. As Cassandra Clare once said, only the very weak-minded refuse to be influenced by literature and poetry, and the even weaker-minded pretend they don't get emotional watching some films. Whoa, hey, you're talking about some of my guests here, Claire. Give them a break. Every week, I invite a special guest over. I tell them they've died, then I get them to discuss their life through the films that meant the most to them. But not today, because today, my friends, is Judgment Day. The world has ended. And James McNicholas stands before me. He has one chance to prove why I should send him to heaven and not to hell. What will happen? Find out in this episode. Check out the Patreon at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein, where you get an extra 20 minutes of chat with James. We talk about secrets. You get the whole episode uncut and ad-free. And there's a video. There's all sorts of other stuff there too. Check it out at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein. So, James McNicholas is back for a third time. He is a brilliant podcaster, writer, football journalist, and stand-up and actor. He's one of my favourite people, and he's one of my favourite guests. If you haven't listened to his last two episodes, I very much strongly suggest that you do, because they are some of the greats. We recorded this on Zoom a couple of weeks ago. It's a delight, as ever. I really think you're going to enjoy it. So that is it for now. I very much hope you enjoy episode 223 of Films to be Buried with Judgment Day. Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried with Judgment Day. It is me, Brett Goldstein, and I'm joined today by an actor, a sketco, a podcaster. He's a husband, he's a father of a dog, he's a lover, he's not a fighter, he is a legend, and he is one of my all-time favourite guests on the show, which is why I'm having him back for the third time. He's a horrible histrier and a boy. Please welcome, he's also a man, welcome to the show, the one and only, I can't believe we managed to get him. Here he is, everyone cheer, it's Mr. James McNicholas!
Woo! Wow, what an intro. Thanks, Brett. Can't believe you managed to get me again. I think yeah. I must be the least famous person to have been on this show three times. And I think that's a record I've got a decent chance of holding.
I will agree to disagree. You're very well known and respected in your field. You are very popular among the cast and crew of Ted Lasso, who are all fans of your work because they all support the wrong team. And yeah, they listen to your disgusting work that you do, your propaganda that you do for that disgusting team. Can we briefly talk about why is that team doing so well? It's really upsetting.
It's weird, isn't it? Yeah, I don't know. It won't last, Brett. It's, you know.
Now you're talking. That's my boy.
Yeah, the pessimist in me says it won't last. But I'm enjoying it while it is. That's the thing. You've got to enjoy the journey.
I mean, it's quite phenomenal.
It is amazing. Yeah. I know that the Arsenal manager, Mikel Arteta, has watched Ted Lasso. So maybe in a way, this is your fault.
Fuck.
I don't know if that's occurred to you as a possibility, but...
Fuck.
Yeah, like all season long, Arsenal going to win the league, and you're going to be like, "How did they do it? How?" And then one day you'll be filming at the Emirates Stadium, go in the dressing room.
There'll be a believe sign,
believe above the door. No, I did this
you
to myself.
Too hard.
Yeah.
Fuck. Okay, but it must be a real treat for you as someone as hardcore as yourself, and you've had a difficult time of it. It must be really something. And are you enjoying it, or are you spending the whole time going, it won't last, it will go away, this is a one-off?
That's the reason I'm saying that's because I'm enjoying it so much. You know, I'm scared that the spell's going to break and we'll turn back into a big footballing pumpkin carriage thing. But no, I'm really enjoying it. And we've suffered for it, Arsenal fans. You know, we were figures of fun for so long. So I'm glad that the supporters have got something to cheer for once, and let's hope it lasts.
That's lovely. Have you, with all your work you've done, your propaganda work for Arsenal, got
the thing about that is I actually get accused of that. I get people on Twitter being like, you work for the club, the owner Stan Kroenke kissed your mum and he's your real dad, and Mikel Arteta and you have a cuddle after every match, you just he whispers things in your ear and you write them. So do be careful with those propaganda allegations.
Well, no, I'm glad you've been reading my tweets. Let me just be clear. It's absolutely true. You do propaganda for the club, but has it got you...
Money. It's very lucrative.
Aside from the riches, has it got you in with the team? Are you talking to these people? Are you close with them? Has that changed your relationship with it?
Yeah, they're much more like real people to me now. You know, I suppose I would be breaking confidences if I was specific. But it is interesting. Like, I tell you the story. So I write about football, you know. That's one of the things I do. And I interviewed a footballer not too long ago. He's an Arsenal player. And we did the interview. And it went well, I thought. We got on. Nice guy. And then afterwards, it sort of got back to me that this particular player had said, oh, I didn't realise... it was going to be that journalist and that publication. I was writing for The Athletic. And he said, if I'd known it was going to be them, I wouldn't have done it. And I was like, why? Why did he say that? And he said, well, apparently 4 years ago, you wrote a piece where, or one of your colleagues, he wasn't sure, wrote a piece where, you know, you sort of slightly criticised the player and used some stats and said maybe he wasn't playing particularly well. And it was just a really interesting thing where you're like, oh, wow, he remembered that. Not only did he read it, he remembered it, and he bore that grudge.
Beast, may I ask you something? Tell me one of the bad reviews that you got many, many years ago at The Fringe, and I bet you can do it word for word.
Yeah, of course. And that is one of the great sort of paradoxes and contradictions of my life, is that I'm a performer, and when I perform, I would say I hold my critics in complete contempt. And yet, I am effectively a football critic. And so reckoning with that duality is a constant internal battle. I am my own enemy.
Has it changed your relationship as a performer then, when you're getting reviewed and all that, or are you still equally?
That would be very grown up, wouldn't it, if the answer was yes, but it's not. I think I genuinely... I sort of said it with an ironic tone that I hold them in contempt, but it is kind of true. Like, I ultimately feel like, you know, what they're doing has not a great deal of worth. I know this is my ego, that my prickled ego after criticism probably, but yeah, I do sort of think, oh, well, we're the ones doing it. You know, what do you know?
Yeah.
Get up on stage. But I'm sure that's how footballers think of me. Kick a ball. I can't. I'm rubbish. But... So, yeah, it hasn't really led to a kind of appreciation. What are you like with critics? Do you like critics? They keep giving you awards, so I imagine you've sort of come round.
Yeah, at the moment I seem to think they're all right. Do you know what? I think it's so difficult. I don't... Sometimes I'm like, the person making the art should never read the reviews because it's a discussion happening about you and your work. I don't know that you should be in on.
Yeah, it's not for you, is it? It's not designed for your validation. I know that that's how it feels as a performer, but a review exists to inform the public of whether or not they might enjoy something.
I don't know. Sometimes you have to follow the trail. If you've been hurt by a critic, like, follow them home and well, the problem see is that they're quite unhappy and you go, oh, okay, you're an unhappy person.
The problem is as well that, like, obviously if you're going to sort of disregard criticism, it means you've got to disregard the positive reviews as well.
But I think you do anyway, right? As in, I think that's the point, is that if I ask you, give me a line from a bad review you've had, you could. But if I say, tell me about your great reviews, could you word for word them? Actually, you probably could. I don't know.
Can you not see? I've got all those written on the walls behind me. They're tattooed across my body. No, I know what you mean. My irritation with reviews often is like commercial. So if you're doing a show, especially in, say, Edinburgh, you're sort of dependent on the reviews slightly to sell the show. Yes. So often, like, the value of like a 4 or 5 star review is purely a commercial one. And when you don't get it, you're like, oh, from a marketing perspective, having put all this work in, that's annoying or frustrating. But the words themselves don't tend to live with me for too long. You know, I've had lovely reviews of things. And, you know, by all means, if there are any critics are listening, continue to write those lovely reviews. but it is something I wrestle with, and it is something that I factor in to my writing about sport. I think I write about sport now, but I do so with kind of the caveat that I accept I can't know as much about that profession as someone who's doing it every single day. And I think all critics would benefit from that perspective.
Yeah, I spoke to a footballer when preparing for Ted Lasso. I had spent some time with an older footballer, and I asked him about critics and commentary and stuff, and he said the reality is no one actually knows how it works. So people are saying all this shit on the TV or in the thing, and they're like, they don't know how we train and how so much of it is rehearsing set pieces and like we have plays planned out. Like, so much of it is not at all what you think. What people are shouting at is wrong. It's like, you don't understand what we've been doing and what we're doing here. You know what I mean? Like, it's almost a different game to what people think it is. And I don't know. Nothing to do with me, and I won't name the show. There's a new show that's come out, and I saw a review for it, and it's a fucking like 12-part show. It must have taken years to make. And the review is simply, the headline is, not worth your time. And then there's a review and you go like, not worth your time. this is many, many people's, at least a year of their life. And you're saying, not worth your time. And that's taken you how long to write that? It's just insane. I do think maybe all critics should have to spend the amount of time it took to make the film to write the review. Maybe that's fair. If they spend a year really thinking and honing this perfect review, then maybe it's like, yeah, okay, I'll listen.
Also, what sort of headline is not worth your time? I mean, who sees a headline saying not worth the time and thinks I might dip into that? I mean, I guess if it was about someone I knew that I didn't like, I probably would read it.
Yeah.
Beyond that. Yeah. I think that's true. And actually, something that exists in sport, which I think exists less in art, is the way that fans or sometimes pundits or writers will kind of talk about a team and say, you know, they didn't want it really. They didn't want it. They didn't work hard enough.
Yeah, yes, this is it.
And I think that's 99% of the time complete projection and completely unfair. Like, these guys are the absolute elite who've given blood, sweat and tears to get to the very top of their sport from being like 6 years old. I think they're capable of working hard. And so I think, you know, you should try and always show people that respect.
I think the things I don't like in reviews that I think are bad is one where you assume the intention, exactly that, where you say either they don't want it or if it's a film where they go like, he clearly feels this, and you go, you don't fucking know that. And the other crime is talking about a different film, like, it should have had more of this or whatever. And you go, yeah, but it didn't. Like, there's a reason it doesn't have more of the film you're imagining. This is the film.
Yeah.
This film. Talk about this film, not the film you'd prefer if you made it. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely, yeah. I do think it's an interesting discussion, that one of, like, do you need to have been part of that process? Like, do you have to have worked in film in some capacity to really be able to write about film with integrity? I guess the answer is no, because an audience member hasn't had that experience, and ultimately they're who it's for. But
I think, for me, simply, the reason criticism should exist is to elevate stuff. That's what I think. As in, stuff you haven't seen that is amazing and perhaps you didn't quite get the first time you saw it, and then you read an essay on it and it's like, because of this and this and this and this, and you're like, oh my God, I need to see that again. And then it like opens a whole world of stuff. That's where I think it serves a great purpose, and it's a sort of wonderful thing.
Like in Ratatouille.
Like in Ratatouille.
You know, no one, unless he writes that review, no one's going to a little restaurant with a rat as a chef.
With a rat head, though.
But he champions it.
At the top of the episode.
Yeah. If you haven't seen Ratatouille, A, what are you doing with your life? B, don't listen on. Fast forward.
You know, Charlie Brooker did a huge 5-minute piece on his show about The Wire and how everyone had to watch The Wire. Thank you, Charlie Brooker. You did good for the world. You know what I mean? Like, I think it all comes down to fucking being... It's all yes-anding again, isn't it? I think if you hate stuff, you should probably keep your mouth shut. That, I guess, is what I think. But it's your job to write a review every week, I guess.
But I guess the interesting thing is that reviewing is also somehow performative. You know, for some people, that is their persona, that they hate stuff.
Mm.
And they play up to that. And that is their art, that they create these little pieces where they take things apart. But yeah, it feels a bit cruel to me.
Yeah, I don't like it. You're a nice boy. Oh, yeah. Now, if we can say this, can we say this? You are mid-shooting Horrible Histories season...
Season, I think 10 and 11, I think.
Two seasons back to back.
Yeah, it's two seasons back to back for CBBC. It's a lot of history.
There's so much history, isn't
it? It's 24 episodes, 24 half hours. I play 126 characters or something.
How many accents are you doing?
Just the one. Sort of like an estuary, close to London accent, someone who's pretending to be less posh than they actually are. Yeah, and it just seems to suit everything I do. No, I'm approximating many accents. I'm working from a core base of about six.
Okay, that's really good.
And then just sort of doing them like louder or quieter, depending on the circumstances. That's what being a star is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm doing on children's television in Britain. Refusing to do accents properly. Because I've reached that level.
You're a bloody hero and an inspiration to us all.
Thanks, mate.
And how is your, as we know, to the long-term listeners and fans of James McNicholas, you will also know he is still married to Camille Udon, who is the other favourite guest of the show, and a woman with huge death anxiety and fear of flying.
But don't we have a laugh? Yeah, she's good. She's good. She's well. I think she won't mind me saying because she's started having therapy now. I think she's maybe talked about that on here before. And I think it's really helped her get a handle on it. She had a session in this very chair a few hours ago. It's still warm with her anxiety. Wow. I can feel it.
Has it, if I may ask, has her doing therapy changed your relationship, changed the way she talks with you? Has it made things, has it led to better things, worse things? Has there been an argument because of therapy? Has it made things easier? How would you describe it?
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because like, if you've ever been in a relationship with someone who's been going to therapy, I think you sort of definitely know when they've been. Like even, you know, normally it's the same time every week, whatever it might be, but there is a tonal difference before and after. A
lot of chat about boundaries all of a sudden.
Yeah, a lot of chat. Yeah, she keeps trying to break up with me afterwards. I don't know what sort of advice she's getting. No, I like this therapist because I find that afterwards, often, you know, if there's been like a disagreement in the week or something, we're not seeing eye to eye on, 9 times out of 10 after the session, that is resolved in some way.
Fantastic.
I don't know, I'm obviously not privy to what goes on, but my experience of it is that this therapist is sat in there saying like, he's a good bloke, this James, you want to give him a break, to be honest. I mean,
and you're not sleeping the therapist's like, money.
Yeah, no, I don't even know who it is. I mean, I've never met them, you know, of course. But
great.
Maybe they're a fan of my podcast. I don't know.
Yes.
Maybe they love Horrible Histories.
Maybe it's Arteta.
Maybe it's Mikel Arteta. But they always seem to be... I'm coming out all right of it so far.
Fantastic.
Which is good. That's ideal.
Nothing better than the therapist taking your side.
No greater
win.
That is the biggest win in a relationship, I think.
I fucking told you.
Yeah.
Great, lovely. Oh, I'm very happy for you.
What happens sometimes, though, is like, I mean, I think all relationships have this, but, you know, sometimes Camille might say, oh, my therapist says this. And I'll be like, I said that 3 weeks ago. Do you know what I mean?
I do know exactly what you mean. You won't take it from me, will you? Yeah. You'll take it from a professional. Okay.
Oh, right. Someone with a qualification rather than just a man with an opinion and an ego.
I've actually got a very popular podcast. Yeah. So.
I put it out to the listeners and they voted. That's what we came to. And that's not good enough for you?
These are good people. James McNicholas. You have died again. What? Why? Because it is Judgment Day. You stand on the edge of heaven and hell. So you must now tell me the best and worst thing you ever did in this life and answer some questions about film. And in the end, I will decide whether you get to go to heaven or hell. Go.
That sounds fair.
Yeah, I think so. What's the worst and best thing you did in this life?
Oh, I didn't know about this bit. But the best as in, like, for the world...
You're selling me you as like, you listen, you're going to go to heaven or you're going to go to hell, and you need to tell me the best and worst thing you did.
Okay. The worst thing I ever did is easier.
Go on.
I've pissed in a lot of people's sinks.
And they haven't known? Like,
they haven't known.
You haven't just walked into their kitchen and done it?
It's not the kitchen. No, it's in the bathroom.
Can you explain, have you got a very high waist? Why do you need...
I just think it's at a better height than a toilet.
Hmm.
Don't get me wrong, I wipe it down afterwards, but I don't know if I should have revealed this on air because no one's going
to
let...
It doesn't matter because you're obviously happy together. It does suggest you've got a very small penis that can that is the right height for a sink. You just pop it, just lay it on the sink. There you go.
It's not
too far down to the toilet.
Is yours long enough that it descends into the toilet?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Brett, congratulations.
Mine's dipping in. I get on tiptoes.
You got a stepladder, haven't you? You take it in with you. Come on, nip to your loo. What's that ladder for? Don't worry about it.
At least I'm not doing it in your sink, am I right? Why are you always popping it in the sink in the bathroom then? I understand if the toilet's busy, you've got to do it in the sink, but the toilet's available and you're still going sink.
I just think it's more practical.
Hmm.
I don't know if it's hereditary because I once told my uncle that I did this and he said, yeah, I do that as well. And we'd never discussed it prior to that point. So somewhere in my genetics.
Right. That's big.
Or small.
Have you pissed in my sink?
I never piss and tell.
Fascinating. What a fascinating view.
What I say is, if you're listening... And you know me, and I've been round your house. Give the sink a little wipe around. Look, you asked me what the worst thing I've ever done is.
And I respect it, because you've been honest. What's the best thing you've ever done? Bleached all the sinks?
Like the kindest thing.
Interpret it how you will. You're trying to impress me so I don't send you to hell for pissing in all the sinks.
I think the best thing I've ever done is being a good brother. I've been a good brother.
Ah, go on.
I'm not sure I've been a good son.
Okay.
Whether I'm a good husband is in the balance.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I've been a good brother. I've got three siblings. They're all younger than me. And I think I've done a decent job of being like a big brother. You know, I've helped them out when I've been able to. And I've offered advice when it's been asked, but never, you know, without...
Unsolicited.
I am not one of those brothers who's like overprotective of my sisters, let them do what they want. Okay, so now you have to decide what happens to me. Or is that the end?
Well, let me see. Based on your two stories, being a good brother is a wonderful, wonderful thing, but pissing in people's sinks is bad.
I think we can all agree.
I still can't decide. Let's ask you some more questions, this time about film, and hopefully that will decide it for me. What is the film that you saw when you were too young to see it that affected you the most?
Okay. By the way, hard doing this because obviously I've picked a load of films for your show already.
I had to go
and look up what I'd done. Fortunately, people have made spreadsheets. Do you know this?
Oh, have they? Great. Someone made a spreadsheet up to 100 and then they said, I can't be bothered to keep doing this.
Yeah, it might have been that one, actually.
That's it. Fair enough.
Yeah, that is reasonable, but very sweet of them to go that far. So the film that I saw when I was too young that affected me. I wasn't way too young to see it, but it was Dante's Peak.
Okay, lovely film.
Yeah,
Linda Hamilton, Pierce Brosnan, a volcano. Yeah.
Only PG-13.
Yeah,
I actually took the liberty of looking it up. Did you know that there's a website called KidsInMind.com, and it goes, it's got like every film in there, like a repository, and it tells you sort of what is potentially offensive within the film. But it's incredibly detailed. Like for Dante's Peak, the section of language says one mumbled F word, some mild obscenities, a few scatological references, a couple of anatomical references, discussion topics, volcanoes, geology, panic, saving people. Message, natural disasters cannot be predicted or controlled. It's categorized every movie in this way. It's a great website. Anyway.
Why did Dante's Peak, how old were you and why did it affect you so much?
I was only about 11, which again, I'm close to the PG-13. If a parent was with me, I would have been fine.
Legal, yeah.
But they weren't, as far as I recall. Do you remember, there's a scene in the film, there's a grandmother character and there's like acid rain because natural disasters are happening.
Right.
And they're on the raft in the middle of like an acid lake. And it looks like they're doomed, essentially. And Grandma jumps off the raft into the acid water and pushes the raft with her kids and grandkids to shore and saves them, effectively. And they drag her out of the acid water and her legs are all burned. You see the burned legs. That's mentioned on kidsinmind.com. Don't worry about it.
That's in the repository, mate.
Yeah, let me tell you, there's something in the repository about that. here you go. A woman wades through acid water, and later we see blood on her face and neck and bloody patchy burns on her legs.
That sounds horrible.
But it sort of really haunted me, actually. And I grew up incredibly close to my maternal grandmother, a woman called Barbara, and I spent loads of my childhood with her. I'd say she's sort of like, she was sort of my favourite person growing up. And I was sort of her favourite person, which was lovely. And that scene, it chilled me. And what chilled me about it was, it wasn't the bloody patchy legs. It was the self-sacrifice that made me so like emotional that I almost couldn't get a handle on it. And it was the first time I really understood that idea of like, a parent or a grandparent being prepared to sort of sacrifice themselves for their loved ones or, you know, their children and grandchildren. And it stayed with me so much that I remember as a kid when I wanted to not go to school, I remember there was a time that I had to motivate myself to cry. It wasn't because I was acting at that point in time. It was just like, oh, I think I need to get some sympathy off mum or dad. And when I used to like really try to cry, I always used to think, just imagine that's your grandma jumping off the raft into the acid water and it would bring me out in floods of tears. So,
but the thing is, we're talking about critics and stuff. That's so fascinating. And this is why there shouldn't be reviews, because Dante's Peak is considered a piece of shit film. And that is a real profound thing that happened to you from that film. Like, amazing.
Yeah.
No one's thinking Dante's Peak's going to really affect you and stay with you for your whole life. And yet here we are.
Well, let's not forget, I am the man who said, I think last time I was on, that the most romantic film I've ever seen was Casper. So...
yeah, it is, though. I mean, that's fair.
There's going to be some unconventional choices. But Dante's Peak, yeah, it stayed with me.
I love that.
And I was young and I was prone to being affected by it, and I was very affected by it. There you go.
I love you and your grandma.
She's in your show, famously. She was in my show. She's good. She's good value.
If you could play one character in a film, which one would it be?
I'd need to be a bit older.
Okay.
But the character is called Randy the Ram Robinson, and it's played by Mickey Rourke in The Wrestler.
You want to be the wrestler?
I want to be the wrestler.
Interesting.
I mean, obviously, like all comic actors, my reflex is to go like the Joker, because I think every comic actor's like... I could do a great Joker. There's like a darkness in me that people haven't really seen yet. And like, if I just get the opportunity, it could really like change perceptions of me. But I thought that was a bit of a cliche. And I also thought you're putting yourself in competition with some
pretty good actors.
Pretty decent performances there. There's like a real heritage around that part. But I've chosen The Wrestler, and the reason being is that sort of a secret passion of mine. I love wrestling.
Not know this.
Yeah. It's quite a sort of low-key thing, but I love it. I'm fascinated by it.
This is why you're really good value on this year, because it's a new massive revelation every time.
And we've known each other years.
I've known you for years, and you've never once mentioned wrestling.
Honestly, on my life, yeah. I'd say once a month, I say to Camille, I'm packing it all in and becoming a wrestler. At least once a month.
You'd be a fucking great wrestler as well.
I know. And that's why I need to play one in a movie. No, the reality is, it's not going to happen now. I've accepted that. I'm not going to be the WWE champion. But
I won't hear talk like that around here.
But I think I would love... Because the other thing is, you've got to think, it's not just about the finished article of the film. Hmm. It's how much am I going to enjoy the process? And presumably, Mickey, when he played that part, had to go to like a wrestling school and get slammed on a mat and chucked around and learn how to throw a wrestling punch. And I would love that aspect of it. Like, I would honestly, it's a dream of mine to train to do that. I can talk more about why, because I think it makes perfect sense. I'm someone who's in the entertainment industry, but I also love sport. And where those two things meet, so like story and character, but the sort of live atmosphere and the drama of sport is in wrestling. That's where they intersect.
Yes.
So I love it. It's like manufactured drama. I love the pageantry. I love the spectacle. I respect the people, the athletes who do it. They work really insanely hard. Like, it's not like other sports. There's no off season. They work like several nights a week. Their bodies get battered and bruised. And that's obviously what happens in the movie. You know, it's a guy who's at the end of his career. And it's actually, I don't know this for a fact, but there's a great documentary film about wrestling called Beyond the Mat, which I really recommend. And it focuses in part on a real wrestler called Jake the Snake Roberts, who was like a big deal in like the 80s and early 90s. And I feel like Mickey Rourke's interpretation of this character is in part based on Jake the Snake Roberts. He's like a man whose life has sort of slightly gotten away from him, and he's kind of caught in the mystique of this persona that he's created, but his real life, his family, is kind of disintegrating around him. And that is a theme of that movie as well that I really am interested in. And another reason I'd love to play the part is that idea of like, when do you give up? Mm. When are you ready to relinquish that part of your life?
When do you give up doing propaganda for Arsenal and become a wrestler? I guess is what you're...
Well, I guess maybe that is the internal question. I mean, I think anyone who's in the arts who is not extremely successful reckons, or even if they are extremely successful, reckons with that question at various points in their life.
Every day. You
know? Yeah. Like, at what point am I just pursuing a dream or doing this because it's become my identity?
Mm.
Am I still contented? Am I still satisfied by the work? Could I be better served by doing something else, being somebody else? I find that question really interesting.
What would be your wrestling name?
Oh, wow. My wrestling name would be...
James the Beast McNicholas.
Yeah, I guess Beast, yeah. The Beast.
Yeah.
It's all there for me.
Yeah.
I've even got like a shaved head now. It's the aesthetic.
Exactly. That's what I'm thinking. I'm looking at you.
And thinking, Beast. I mean, I'm a bit more sort of like British Beast, wrestler Beast, from the
Beast,
80s.
Beast, that's what people are shouting at the side.
I know.
As you come out.
Brett, you're getting me excited now. That is sort of my dream. It never was. It came to me late. I just sort of fell for it as a world. And I do think it's a good film, The Wrestler. And I think it's a hell of great a film. Part, that.
Lovely, lovely answer.
Yeah.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hacks is back for season 3, and so is the official Hacks podcast. In each episode, Hacks creators Lucia Aniello, Paul W. Downs, and Jen Statsky speak with cast and crew members to unpack the Emmy-winning comedy series. You'll hear Hannah Einbinder and Jean Smart speak to their on-screen dynamic, along with Hacks writer and actor Pat Regan, on how their improv experience helped them when shooting scenes and what it was like writing scripts for specific actors.
You'll also hear from crew members like the costume designers on what it was like creating the world that Deborah and Ava inhabit. Hear stories from the show's writer's room, on-set antics, and more. Watch Hacks streaming exclusively on Max, and listen to the official Hacks podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
What is the worst date you ever had at a film? Or time. Could be worst time.
I struggle with this one, you know. I really struggle with it.
You're good at
I've
dates.
Got an answer. I'm just too good at dates. No one's ever had a bad date with me. Don't write in.
Comment section closed.
Yeah. If we could all focus on the pissing in sink stuff, just let that attract all
I'm
the attention.
I'm a good guy.
Yeah. I've got one. It's not a feature-length film. I hope that's acceptable. You tell me.
Let's hear it.
Raymond Briggs. Are you aware of Raymond Briggs?
The Snowman.
The Snowman.
When the Wind Blows.
Right. He's got one called Father Christmas. Yeah, and it's not a feature-length film, but it's a lovely Christmas film. It's based on a book that Ray Briggs did. I think Raymond Briggs died quite recently, didn't he? And it's brilliant. And it's a Christmas tradition in my house that we watch it on Christmas Eve. In my childhood house growing up. And one Christmas about, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago, when we were all sort of getting a bit too old for that to be a thing, we had a big row as a family in the house on Christmas Eve. Just like over nothing, you know? Yeah. Like, well, you said we weren't doing presents this year. That kind of thing. And
you hadn't brought any presents. I get it.
Okay. Yeah. And somebody said, right, well, we haven't, and guess what? We haven't watched Father Christmas. So that's Christmas ruined, sort of thing. And then someone was like, right, well, have you got it? You got the DVD? Right, well, we'll put it on then. And we put it on and sat, not making eye contact, in awkward, like stiff silence for 32 minutes or whatever it is of Father Christmas going around, like, oh, get all the presents ready. We all just sat there fuming with each other. So
that's really funny. You hate watched Father Christmas.
We hate watched Father Christmas on Christmas Eve. And it's like the thing that brings me most joy. We sat there being like, right, well, I suppose we'll watch it then. Yeah, well, we will watch it then. Well, I suppose we'll have a fucking mince pie while we're doing it, will we? Yes. Like that.
I'm enjoying this. You're enjoying this? Happy Christmas.
This is so festive, you fucking piece of shit. Maybe I'm not a good brother. I don't know.
I forget presents once a year. Give me a break. I'm too busy in the sink. If you could live in the world of one film, which would it be?
Right, well, I thought about this because there are some amazing worlds depicted in films. Yeah. And I love fantasy and sci-fi. And so that sounds appealing, but they're death traps, most of them. Like
sci-fi worlds, yeah, often, yeah.
Yeah.
Or world.
Exactly. No, like, you know, if you hop into Lord of the Rings or whatever, an orc's taking you out early doors or dragons eating you or something. So my answer, I think I've actually cracked this, is James Cameron's Avatar. Mm-hmm. And the reason being is that the mechanic in Avatar is that you're a human in a spaceship, effectively, and you jump in a little pod, and then you get to be one of these avatars, aliens, running around experiencing Pandora, I believe the planet is called. We're all about to hear a lot more about it. And basically, if you die as an avatar, you don't die in real life. Do you see what I'm saying?
Right, yes, I do see what you're saying.
So you get to be there in 3D or whatever it is. I don't know what he's up to, Cameron, these days.
IMAX.
You're in the IMAX. You're like, all the plants are lovely colours. Look at the animation on that. Wow. Your legs are a bit long. That sort of stuff's happening. But if something should befall you, you fall down a hole, you get shot, you just wake up a bit stressed in the spaceship.
Yeah.
I think I seem to remember. Yeah, I seem to remember in Avatar 1, as I guess it will soon be known, you just sort of wake up a bit like, oh, that was lucky that was just my avatar and not me. So basically, the answer is Avatar, because you get to explore the world without consequences.
Without actually going there. Great answer. Correct. I'd say that's correct, actually.
Great, thanks.
What is your favourite children's film?
Oliver.
Yes.
Brilliant film.
So dark. Have you I watched it again recently. Boy, is that a dark You film.
It's very, very dark, but there's just some incredible... Look, I love the music. I remember I saw the show when I was a kid. But the performances in it... I mean, Ron Moody's performance as Fagin is sensational. Oliver Reed...
Incredible.
He's in there as Bill Sykes.
That's my dream role. Well, I mean, it is basically what I did for Roy Kent. But
yeah. That's so true.
It's who I based him on. It's Bill Sykes with a bit more emotional availability.
Was Oliver Reed the ex-footballer that you spent time with preparing? I didn't know he played. How interesting.
He did, yeah. He was always like, they don't know what I'm doing out there. And I was like, yeah, no one does.
And just the scale of the production is... extraordinary. Yeah, I honestly, it's an amazing film. And I feel like as a kid, it was always on. Like maybe it was again like a Christmas thing, but I feel like it was on telly an unusual amount.
Every bank holiday, at least, it was on.
Yeah, I reckon it still is. I reckon they're still rolling it out. Yeah, and I can't knock it. I just think it's got drama, it's poignant, great music, big numbers. It's got everything you want. You a fan?
I love it. I absolutely love it. And I, in all seriousness, did see it recently and was like surprised how dark the last sort of 20 minutes of it are. I mean, like really dark, like man gets hung, woman gets battered to death, you know, kid. There isn't really a happy, he just sort of is returned to these people that will look after him, but it isn't, it's kind of weirdly sort of...
He's still been through a lot of trauma at the end.
Yeah, he's
he,
been
Oliver?
Through, it's quite a melancholic end. It isn't like a sort of yay ending. It's like, oh God, I mean, I hope he's going to be all right. They've all been through quite a lot.
He'll need some therapy. That's for
sure. He's going to need so much therapy. And hopefully, but if it's Camille's therapist is going to say, well, Bill Sykes was probably in the right, actually.
Hang on. Am I Bill Sykes in this relationship?
Of course you are. Look at you.
That's true, actually. Big, scary wrestler.
Bill the Beast Sykes. What is the film that you didn't think you would like that you ended up loving?
It's The Big Short. And it's because I didn't, as a premise, think that I would really engage with a movie about the financial crash. And actually, even in the first 15 minutes of it, I was like, I need a glossary for this film. Do you know what I mean?
If I told you that The Big Short lost me maybe 5 minutes in, where someone looks at camera and said, I think it's Brad Pitt, looks at camera and goes, I'll make this simple for you, for people who don't understand anything. You have bonds, right? And I wanted to put up my hand and go back further. I don't know what a bond is.
Yeah, that's true. You've
just simplified it and I've already lost. I'm lost on step one if you're simplifying.
Well, I didn't see it in a cinema and I think that was crucial because if I recall correctly, at those points in the movie, I was pausing and Googling stuff. Now,
smart.
You could argue the movie hasn't successfully done its job if I'm having to Google it. But I think maybe most people, Brett, with like real jobs, know what bonds are.
Yeah.
I think we are the exception, not the rule.
We just think it's a spy. We're like, what?
Yeah.
Talking about bonds. Everyone's got bonds. And the bonds shorted. I'm like, what are you on about? Speak English.
But in the end, it won me round. And listen, I mean, I should have known really because it's Adam McKay and I've liked a lot of his stuff. And I only saw it quite recently. And actually, it's one of those things where, I watched it on a streaming service because I remember I was sort of pausing and starting and being like, oh, okay, so that's that. And I genuinely learned something. I mean, it was sort of an area of recent history that I'll hold my hands up. I knew nothing about and I took quite a lot away from it.
Which part are you playing when they do the Horrible Histories episode of it?
I don't know. Hopefully Steve Carell. He's got a cool part in that. It is scary, by the way. Horrible Histories, you think of it as like, oh, we do like the Tudors and we do like Romans and ancient Greeks. Mm. In the forthcoming series, there is a sketch set in the year I was born. 1986. What? It's about the first mobile phones.
Jesus, that is scary.
Yeah.
God, have you literally run out of history? Jesus.
I think we're running out, guys. I know. We're caught up. It's like The Crown.
You're going to have to slow down.
We're caught up and now it's awkward.
What is the single most erotic moment in film?
Right. What are people saying for this? I mean...
I've only had two. I can't even remember. Probably something, you know, fake, like, oh, the feel of the breeze on my skin.
Exactly. I remember coming on this show the first time and complaining about that. People weren't actually choosing.
This question's here for you.
Thanks,
I want
mate.
The real shit.
Well, you know what's interesting is that out and out sex scenes in movies, I don't think are often hugely erotic. I don't know if you feel the same, but I just feel like there's a the eroticism for me at least often exists in like the tension.
Yeah.
The one I've chosen, have you seen a movie called Don John?
Yes, I have. And I think it's wildly underrated.
It's a brilliant
film. I was amazed it wasn't a hit. It's a great film.
And I think he's really good, Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I think he directed it.
Me too. He did. He wrote and directed it.
And I think it's a great, I think it's a really nice movie.
Yeah.
I thoroughly recommend it. And he plays opposite Scarlett Johansson in it.
Mm.
And there's a scene where they are outside her front door.
I know the scene. Keep talking. Bring it home.
They're outside her front door and she's like, I've got to go inside. And he's like this very sort of jockish ladies man. And basically she's sort of dry humping him outside of the corridor, isn't she?
Yeah.
But she's talking to him while she's doing it. She's sort of giving him some dirty talk. And he desperately wants to go inside and he can't, but she knows that he wants to. And she's very powerful in that moment. And this guy who's like, the consummate ladies man is sort of slightly brought to heel by Scarlett Johansson's character. And it is incredibly charged and erotic. And it feels very real, Christian.
Yeah.
Like, it's a credit to their performances because it feels like a true private moment. And it feels authentic to, like, experiences you've had in your life, I think, a bit as well. Like, I don't know, this feels like insanely personal, but like, you know, the sort of traditional movie thing of like, oh, we met, we fell in love, we, you know, going through and tear each other's clothes off, and that's fine. But it's all sort of, I think real life's always a bit more, there's more sort of forwards and back and one, you know, brakes and accelerator. And this captures that quite well. I don't know if you agree.
I think that is an excellent answer and a very erotic moment and a great film. That was totally missed out on.
That see, this is what critics should be doing. Telling people to go and see Don John. Maybe they did.
Which film you don't care about as a whole has a single sequence that you love? So you don't like the film, but there's a bit in it that you're like, that's fucking one of the great bits.
Small Soldiers.
Yes. Joe Dante's Small Soldiers.
Joe Dante's Small Soldiers. Joe Dante, who made the Gremlins films.
Yeah.
It's Kirsten about
Dunst.
Yeah.
Tommy Lee Jones?
Yeah, he's the voice. It's about some sentient toys, effectively, that are at a war with each other. I think what the plot is that the military develop some sort of AI, military, highly intelligent microchip, and it gets implanted, either by accident or by design, into these children's toys, and they end up in a house and go haywire. And there is a sequence or a scene where the sort of bad toys, they're called the Commando Elite. I think Tommy Lee Jones is the leader. And they're hanging out in a garage and the young lad in it and Kirsten Dunst sort of escape from the house. And they're like, we're away from the nasty toys. Everything's fine. And then the garage door blows off, like a hole gets blown in it. And that song by Edwin Starr that goes, war, huh? Yeah, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing.
Say it again.
And then all these toys come out on these like improvised vehicles they've made out of things they found in the garage. So they've like stuck wheels on a cheese grater. And it's just like, it's the moment the movie has been building towards. You're like, there are these toys with malicious intent and military genius. At what point are we going to see that manifest? And then the garage doors blow off and these five vehicles come out and Tommy Lee Jones, as a toy, he stood on the top. You got that song in the background and it's just a great scene. It's a great scene. And then a little chase ensues. It's top stuff.
I believe that that song, War, is also in the Barry Levinson film, Toys.
Really?
I believe so. And they're both about toys.
It's used in a few movies, for sure.
Really, really good answer, Beast. You're very good. What is the film that stayed with you the longest after seeing it? You know what I mean? Took a while to let go of it. Obviously, there are films you remember forever, but where you're like, I was crying for a week or whatever. I was horny for a week, let's say.
Sure, yeah. It's Don John, I think. I think, and this I'd say is one of my less maybe niche choices, I think it was This Is England, actually. Mm-hmm. I really loved that film. I thought it was brilliant. And a central performance from,
Stephen Graham.
Stephen Graham.
Yeah.
Is just extraordinary. And the scene where he sort of beats somebody up in a racially motivated attack, I feel like that film did to me what that character does. So that character arrives and he's charming and captivating and alluring, and everyone is kind of sucked into his orbit. And there's a threat of violence in the background. Mm-hmm. But then it all explodes in that one scene and all the darkness of his character floods in. And I feel like my relation to the movie was parallel to that, where as I was watching it, I was like, wow, this is so great. Such an interesting, you know, colourful depiction of like life in a particular period of time in England. And there are these characters who I'm sort of falling for and I empathise with. And even Stephen Graham's character, it's like he holds a sort of roguish appeal. And then I felt like that movie just like, bam, just beat the crap out of me, basically. And it's brutal. It's really brutal. And it lived with me for a little while. And I still think about it quite a lot, actually. I've not watched that film quite a long time because I genuinely find that scene really difficult.
Yeah. Is this why you shaved your head?
To become a racist thug. No, it's to be a wrestler, Brett.
So sorry.
The real reason is because it makes horrible histories easier because they can tape the wigs to my head.
I'll say this. You are fucking cool as fuck and you're going to make a great wrestler.
Thanks, man. I'm really looking forward to it.
Suits you. Are you going to keep it like this after horrible history?
Interesting question. I don't know. I think my agent's a bit like wary of me keeping it. I've sort of explained that.
Do you like it?
Yeah, I do like it. But I do see that you might get pushed down an alleyway. But then if I want to play the wrestler, then maybe that's not a problem.
Exactly. Thank you. What is the film that made you feel better about the world?
It's School of Rock, actually.
Yeah.
How could it not?
Love it.
I genuinely will go and watch the final performance that they do for School of Rock if I'm feeling blue.
Yeah.
And by the way, I love Jack Black. I have to say, like, I really, really
love Jack Black.
I think he's absolutely extraordinarily talented.
Do you want to come with me to see Tenacious D live when they come in the summer?
So much. Like, in the last fortnight, I've spent quite a lot of time watching clips of Tenacious D.
Amazing.
And he's an incredible, incredible performer.
He really is.
And I think he's great on screen. He manages to sort of be big and wild and crazy, but it never feels out of place. And what I love about this movie is how earnest it is, how unapologetically earnest it is. Like, there's no veil of irony to it, and it would be so easy for there to be.
Yeah.
And I guess that shouldn't be a surprise. If you look at, like, Richard Linklater's other films, like, there is that earnest quality, I think, that runs through
them.
That's
true, yeah.
And I think that...
Yeah, he's not a snarky guy.
No. And I think, and genuinely, like, as someone who's sort of professionally snarky, I think, like, as comics, like, we're often, like, quite professionally snarky. Mm. As I get older, I'm increasingly interested in, like, how can we just be, like, finding permission to just be earnest and for that to be okay for me. And, and I think you're very good at that, actually. I think you're pretty good at that. Mm-hmm. But School of Rock is exemplary at it, and it's just so much fun. It makes you think... Ah, everything's all right in the world.
Yeah, yeah. You know what? It's an interesting, like, behind-the-scenes thing that I learned about School of Rock, which maybe is, like, a thing that will go towards your thought on it, is that I think in the original script, you know, he's replacing a teacher. He's substituting a teacher, Mr. Schneebly. He gets a phone call, we need a replacement teacher. And I think in the original script, the teacher was injured or the teacher broke their leg, and maybe you saw that. And Jack Black was like, I don't want any injury. I don't want it to have been something nasty or sad that's happened. Like, as in,
That's really interesting.
You don't want there to be any sort of darkness about this teacher. Like, where's this teacher gone? And, like, it shouldn't be... I think it was sort of done as a joke. You see this person break their leg or something like that, and he was like, I don't want that.
Wow. Yeah, but great. That fits perfectly.
Yeah. What is your favourite couple in a film?
It's Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore in The Wedding Singer.
Wow. I mean, one of my top 10 couples is Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore in 50 First Dates.
Yeah. Well, I actually think Adam Sandler, Drew Barrymore, it's interesting, isn't it, how some couples, particularly in rom-coms, just have a certain chemistry, you know, like Hanks and Ryan.
Yeah.
And I think those two, Sandler and Barrymore, are so, again, believable on screen. Like, their relationship feels so real. But in The Wedding Singer, there's just a couple of things. I mean, it's a film I really loved, like, when it came out. And I was only young and I really enjoyed it. But there's a couple of things, like, they're friends. They're proper friends. She's, like, a good friend to him. And he goes through a breakup. And I always... I'm drawn to that because my own relationship is like that. We were friends first and, you know, sort of nursed each other through breakups as friends and then ended up getting together. So I've got a soft spot for anything like that. Sounded like I was going to cry then, but actually I just had a cough. but there's also a little bit in that movie that really stays with me. I don't know if you remember, but I think he's just been left at the altar and he tells Drew Barrymore he's written a song.
Yeah.
And I think the song is called Somebody Kill Me, Please.
It's really great.
It's really funny. It's like starts as like a gentle ballad and it ends with him just like screaming into the microphone. I think the lyrics are, I want to die, pretty yeah. please, somebody kill me. And the camera cuts back to Drew Barrymore and she's sort of, as it's been progressing, she's sort of looked a little bit alarmed. But when it sort of gets to the end and he's at his most broken, she's sort of smiling.
Yeah.
Like, she says, like, that was great. And she's kind of laughing at him. And when he is at his most ugly and his most broken, she sees something sort of funny and gentle in that when he's screaming abuse about somebody in a song. And I think that's a great quality in a couple.
What film inspired you to do something?
Slight roundabout answer to this. The film is Soul. Yes. Animated movie.
One of the all-time greats.
And the interesting thing about it is that the message of that film is kind of that it's not about doing one thing, you know, having these great dreams and ambitions, but it's about appreciation of life in its moment-to-moment experience. And I think because of who I am and the work I have done or do and kind of work I've wanted to do, I've always thought about my life in terms of like, if I could just get that job, if I could just play that part, if I could just get that script commissioned, if I could just persuade that footballer that I'm not a wanker, all these things.
It was 4 years ago, forgive me.
Let it go, boy. nearly said his name. Nearly said his name. They'll be listening to that. They'll ask be like, listen, who was it? I've always been sort of guilty of thinking about my life in terms of those achievements and milestones. And that's obviously what character Joe in Soul goes through, where his focus is so on, oh, I've got this big break, this potential big break. And he kind of pursues it almost at the expense of everything else. And in there's that incredible scene where he sits down at the piano and he plays a piece of music. It's called Epiphany. And it's it's co-written by Trent Reznor, who's the guy from like Nine Inch Nails. And in that, I think as he's playing or just before he plays it, he sort of has all these like trinkets from his experiences in his life. And he realizes that, you know, this thing that he's got on this pedestal is this ultimate dream and goal and ambition. That's not why he's here. It's not defining. And that, you know, real purpose and meaning can be found in the day to day. So that movie inspires me to try and keep that perspective and remember that it's not the destination, it's the journey, and you know that there is joy and satisfaction to be found just in being here.
Based that sequence that you talk about, I have watched it, I have used it for my mental health. Like, I have watched it a lot. I think it is one of the, it is a very, very, very special, profound sequence, and I'm very glad that you picked it.
And it's mental that it's in a kids' film. I mean, Honestly.
But it's also such a complicated, it's such a, I think of all the Pixar films and every time they sort of top them, but it's such a, like, it's so unusual for a Hollywood film where the message is completing the mission, following your dream is not the answer. The answer is leaves. Mm. That is like fucking huge.
But it doesn't surprise me that that would resonate with you as well. Cause you know, well, no, cause we're in similar worlds. And I think if you're in these worlds, you may be prone to forgetting that. And that's partly what the movie's about. I also think another layer is added to it by the fact that it is written by Trent Reznor. And, you know, in the 90s, he was writing and recording music. It was so dark and about a man sort of nihilistic almost in terms of like destroying himself. And he was almost living it as art. Mm. And now he's at another point in his life doing very different work and with a very different perspective. You know, when you know that as well, I think it adds another layer to that sequence. It is an amazing, amazing sequence.
Beast,
mm.
You have answered all the questions very well. And now I must decide, will you go to heaven or will you go to hell? Who will be surprised that, of course, after all these wonderful answers, I'm sending you to heaven. Well done. You've made it. But that doesn't mean I won't resurrect you. In the end, you could offer to give me one... Oh, no, I missed a bit. In the end, you could offer to give me one film that is meaningful in the hope I will spare you. Then I will make my final decision. No spoilers. I sort of already made it.
Okay. It's got to be Soul, hasn't it? It's got to be Soul.
Correct. You're back into heaven. Well done.
Yes!
Beast. James the Beast McNicholas. I look forward to seeing you wrestle in heaven with your friends.
Thanks, man.
And Arteta, who may not be in heaven.
What I look forward to coming back.
Yeah, well, you're always welcome. You are truly a magnificent, thoughtful, funny, sensitive and brilliant man. Is there anything you would like to tell people to listen to, look out for or watch in the coming months?
No, not really. I mean, you know, I'm in a few movies here and there. But I won't tell you which, and then people will just be like, that's that guy from Brett's podcast. No, and listen, go and watch Don John.
Yeah, if we've done anything this week.
If we've done anything, it's established that people need to go and watch Don John. That's my message to you.
Great. Beast, I love you. Thank you. Have a wonderful time in heaven. I'll see you soon.
I will do. I look forward to coming back for the fourth one.
Thank you.
Films to be buried with, Brett's run out of famous friends.
I'll work on a new concept.
You just have to name 15 other films you've seen that you haven't mentioned so far.
Yeah, every question is, go on, tell me another one. What else? What else have you seen? Okay.
All right.
Good day to you.
Bye.
So that was episode 223. Head over to the Patreon at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein for the extra 20 minutes of chat, secrets and video with James. Thank you so much to James for giving me his time. I very much hope you're all well. I really appreciate you listening. Next week's going to be another banger. Thanks to Scroobius Pip and the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks to Buddy Peace for producing it. Thanks to Acast for hosting it. Thanks to Adam Richardson for the graphics and Lisa Lydon for the photography. Come and join me next week for another incredible guest. But that's it for now. In the meantime, have a lovely week, and please, now more than ever, be excellent to each other. Sometimes I dream of becoming an actor. Have you ever dreamt of becoming an actor? Maureen, what is it you think I do for a living? Never mind, sounds like you need the New York Film Academy. NYFA offers workshops, BFA and MFA degrees and summer camps in filmmaking, acting, journalism and more, online and on campuses across the globe.
to make films alongside industry professionals. Explore more at nyfa.edu. Thanks, Brett. Thank you, Maureen.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right. That's right.